And right now I'm joined on the phone by Antonia Juhas. She is a policy analyst, author, and activist living in San Francisco. She is a visiting scholar at the Washington, D.C.-based Institute for Policy Studies. She's also an expert on all aspects of international trade and finance policy, with a master's degree in public policy from Georgetown University, experience as a legislative assistant to two United States members of Congress, and over 10 years of work in the field. She's also on the board of directors of Washington, D.C.-based Oil Change International, a research and education organization that exposes the high costs of the oil economy and advocates for meaningful alternatives. And she's joining me today to talk about the pending Iraq oil law. Hello, Antonia.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So let's start off, if you can give us an overview to start off with of U.S. policy around oil in Iraq.
Well, basically, I would argue that the United States has now fought at least two wars in Iraq to try and gain greater access to Iraq's oil, not just for U.S. oil companies, but also so that the U.S. government would have greater control over one of the world's largest reserves of oil, and not just largest reserves. I think the best way to think about Iraq for this conversation is to imagine Iraq as a giant pimple of oil that hasn't yet been plucked. It's definitely has the second or third largest reserves of oil in the world, but some people believe that once it's really been explored, it might have as large of reserves as Saudi Arabia does. But of its 80 known oil fields, only 17 have even begun to be developed, and so there's a tremendous amount of untapped oil. And it's extremely cheap to get at. It only costs about a dollar per barrel to produce oil from Iraq. But of course, as of today, Iraq's oil is selling at more than $54 a barrel. So it's also highly profitable. And U.S. oil companies throughout the reign of Saddam Hussein have been denied access to Iraq's oil under the ground, even though Saddam has allowed U.S. oil companies to market some of Iraqi oil. And I would argue that both the first Bush administration war to unseat Saddam Hussein that failed, and then the second Bush administration war to not just unseat Saddam, but to completely rewrite his economic and political infrastructure and to replace his entire government, is the war we're in now. And that war is unfortunately, in many ways, coming quite close to succeeding in locking in U.S. corporate and government control to Iraq's oil.
I wanted to mention as well that you've written a book, The Bush Agenda, Invading the World, One Economy at a Time. Can you talk about the book?
Yeah, the book is about looking at the Bush administration's sort of unique take on corporate globalization policy. I know your listeners are familiar with the World Trade Organization and World Bank and International Monetary Fund. Basically, the Bush administration's unique approach to corporate globalization is to use the military to advance a very traditional corporate globalization agenda, locking in access to U.S. corporations through the invasion of Iraq. But the administration is also unique in that its corporate interests are actually quite narrow, as opposed to, say, President Clinton, who is sort of a free-for-all corporatist. The Bush administration has really targeted interest in the corporations that it serves, and those corporations tend to have everything to do with the administration itself. So I point out that the Bush administration is the first U.S. A government in history to have a president, vice president, and secretary of state as all former oil or energy company officials. And actually, both President Bush and Condoleezza Rice have more experience running oil companies than they do working for the United States government. I think it's really well known that Bush runs oil companies into the ground, but it's still his background and still his deepest economic connection. And then Condoleezza Rice, very well known that she had a Chevron oil tanker named after her, the Condoleezza, but less well known that she, in fact, earned it. She spent 10 years on the board of directors of Chevron, and she was the head of its policymaking committee. And, of course, the oil and gas industry just heavily invested in this administration, donating 13 times more money to this administration than its challenger in the first presidential election. Together with oil, weapons, of course, are key. And Lockheed Martin is another company with deep connections to this administration. And then I look at sort of the infrastructure of empire, and there's where you get at companies like the Bechtel Corporation, largest engineering company in the world, also with deep connections to this government. And then all of these companies, Halliburton included, have very deep and long-term interests in Iraq, and that sort of brings us back first full circle to this war, their interests in this war and their profits from this war.
What kind of laws exist currently in Iraq that govern the handling of oil, and what is on the table for the future, and how does the Bush administration influence that, and who has a say in what is decided about how Iraq's oil is handled and who gets the profits?
Well, currently Iraq, just like all of its neighbors and actually all oil-rich countries in the world, has a fully nationalized oil system, which means that essentially for Iraq, that beginning early in the 60s, but for most of these countries in the 70s, when there was a shift in attitude, which was that the oil-rich countries, instead of allowing U.S. and British corporations to own their oil, they took their oil back and took control of their oil and nationalized their oil system. And the national government explores for the oil and produces the oil in Iraq and in all of these countries. And in some countries, the national oil company or the state government also signs contracts with foreign oil companies to provide technical services or marketing of their oil and the like. What U.S. corporations and other corporations would really like is just to swing the pendulum back to a time when they own the oil under the ground and when they have greater control of the last remaining oil reserves. And they're trying to achieve that through persuasion in some countries, through trade agreements in other countries, and in Iraq through a military invasion and occupation. So the Bush administration, well before the war, began designing plans for a post-invasion Iraq that would open up its nationalized oil system to private foreign corporate ownership and essentially all but privatize the oil system. And through a slow, careful process working with the Iraqi governments that have been in place since the invasion, they have succeeded in seeing a new oil law be drafted and now make its way out of a key committee in the Iraqi government to now bring the law before the parliament that essentially fulfills that agenda, all but privatize Iraq's oil and open it to private corporate investment. The question remaining is how good the terms are going to be for foreign companies. And essentially, the Bush administration has just been putting immense pressure on the al-Maliki government to pass this oil law. And the pressure really went public with the completion of the Iraq Study Group report, which, while the press completely ignored this aspect, on page one of the Iraq Study Group report, it said that Iraq is important to the world and Iraq is important to the United States because it has the second largest reserves of oil in the world. And then it recommended that the position of the United States should be to get the Iraqi government to privatize its oil system, and that U.S. troops should be committed to seeing that purpose through. Following the release of the study group report, the president for the first time announced publicly the al-Maliki government has to pass this new oil law. That was followed by U.S. Ambassador Zalmay Khalilzad and then General Casey making the same public pronouncement. Then the surge was announced, and then the al-Maliki government said, okay, we're going to put the oil law forward. And that's where we are today.
What kind of pressure is the Bush administration bringing to bear on the Iraqi government to acquiesce to this attempt by the U.S. to create basically a situation where the nationalized oil system will be handed over to private foreign corporate control. What kind of pressure are they, if you can give some examples of exactly what they're doing to get Iraq to acquiesce to this?
Well, those public statements which I just mentioned and the announcement of the surge, and then, of course, the presence of 150,000 foreign troops and the statement that those troops won't be withdrawn unless the Iraqis meet specific conditions. And one of those conditions is passage of the oil law. The way the president talks about the oil law in public is that it's all about the sharing of Iraq's oil revenues between the regions. It is about that, but it's also about a lot more, which is fundamentally changing the structure of Iraq's oil economy. And as I said, the question is that's on the table is just how far the Iraqis going to go. So the proposal that the oil companies want and the Bush administration wants is something called production sharing agreements, which would retain technically ownership of the oil with the state government, but then all of the functions of the state oil industry would be privatized out, and foreign companies would get ownership of the oil reserves which they work on. And according to the version of the bill, before the current version of the bill, the terms would be that the foreign oil companies would get 70% of the profits, and Iraqis would only get 30% of the profits, and that the oil contracts would last for 30 years, locking in the Iraqis to that period of time for the contract. And that during those 30 years, the economic policies in place in Iraq, and my book goes into this in extensive detail, looking at the tremendous economic policy change put in place in Iraq by Paul Bremer, the head of the occupation government of Iraq, essentially implementing this corporate globalization agenda on the ground, all of those policies would be locked in for the length of the oil contract. And in addition, oil companies would have control over how much was produced, putting Iraq's membership in OPEC up in the air, really. Most recently, because of public resistance in Iraq, and including in the United States and in the European Union, it seems that that worst-case scenario, the production-sharing agreements, have been technically stripped from the law. However, what the Iraqi government has said is that it's going to go on a fact-finding mission to determine what's the best kind of contract for it to use. And it's going to go on a fact-finding mission to the United States, Britain, and Norway to answer those questions. Again, opening itself incredibly to the pressure of the Bush administration and U.S. oil corporations.
I'm speaking with Antonia Juhas. She is a visiting scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies based in Washington, D.C. She's also author of The Bush Agenda, Invading the World One Economy at a Time, and you can go to her website at thebushagenda.net. So just yesterday there was a hearing. The Senate Committee on Foreign Relations held a hearing to investigate, quote, oil and reconstruction strategy in Iraq. Can you talk about the significance of that, if any?
You know, I can talk about the significance of the hearing, but I don't know what happened at the hearing because I haven't heard reports from it yet. Probably more important at this point in what's happened in the last day is, of course, the President's State of the Union, where he specifically made a link, which he's been making several times in the public now, which is essentially that the United States needs to remain in Iraq to ensure that Iraq's oil doesn't get turned over to the terrorists, because then the terrorists will have more resources with which to attack us. And that's a position he's repeated. He also again repeated the progress of the Iraqis on this revenue-sharing aspect of the oil law. And he talked a lot about, really startlingly to me, that the United States needs to reduce its use of oil by 20% over the, use of gasoline by 20% over the next 10 years. He's going to look at fuel efficiency for cars, alternative fuels, and this had to have made the oil companies. I mean, I'm sure a deal was made that he said, you know, I'm going to talk about these things And I'm also going to, continue our war for oil in Iraq. But those are still fairly startling announcements to come from this administration. And I think what that points to is the administration's knowledge that the American public is starting to wake up to the fact that this is a war for oil, that there can't be any other explanation for why we're still there, why he refuses to leave. And it seems clear to me that he's keeping troops in Iraq to see this oil agenda fulfilled, the law passed, the contract signed, and the corporations getting to work. And I think the American public is waking up to this, and I think that was reflected in his State of the Union, that the American public has no interest in a war for oil, won't support it, and would flatly reject it. And the proposals that he made are very much out of character for him, and hopefully reflect a realization that this just is an agenda that we're going to put up with.
You say the American people overall don't really agree with the idea of a war for oil, and I certainly would agree that probably the majority don't agree with that, but I have talked to a fair number of people here in this country who are of the attitude that, well, yeah, it's under their sand, but, you know, this is part of the world power dynamic, who controls the petroleum. You know, that's the basis of the global economy, right? So if the U.S. government puts us in a position to control that, well, that's just world power politics. And, you know, if we want to be on top, we've got to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So what would you say to somebody who had the attitude that, well, that's just the way it is, and we've got to play the game and have control of that, or else we're going to be, I don't know what, down the line we're going to be replaced by China or India or whatever.
Right. That is certainly a position that people make. Basically my response to that is that it's a tremendous gamble on an issue called safety, put in quotation marks. First of all, of course, it's illegal to launch wars for oil. There are very specific requirements that the international law places on countries waging war, and they have just about everything to do with clear defense. That literally there's troops amassing at your border, and you need to repel them through an act of war. There also is something called proportional response, that if you respond in war to an attack with an attack, you can only respond in proportion to the attack being launched against you. So, of course, the very notion that we are right or just in fighting wars for oil because it defends our security somehow is completely contrary to international law. It's also, of course, immoral, but we'll put that aside. In terms of security, if Americans are attuned to the fact that this is a war for oil, believe me, the rest of the world is attuned to it as well. And that makes the rest of the world very angry at the United States. And if we're taking oil from those very nations that we deem to be the most dangerous, then we can be sure that the response is going to be just as it has been since the war in Iraq, increased attacks against those who support the United States and the United States itself, increased sentiment across the Middle East and Arab nations of hostility towards the United States, and, really setting ourselves up to be even more of a global pariah than we are today. And that's, oil is one item of security for a nation, but that security is greatly challenged if by acquiring that oil we increase our status as the most hated nation in the world.
For those Americans, for the majority, who don't agree with the idea of going to war for oil and who are upset and angry at having been lied to about the reasons for the war, what would you suggest to them that they might be able to do to change the situation?
It's actually quite simple. We have to push forward with the clear demand of removing troops from Iraq now, removing funding for the war now. That's the only way that the Iraqis will have any opportunity to make decisions about their oil fate on their own, freed from the pressure of the U.S. government and U.S. corporations. And right now there's a tremendous amount happening with January 27th being a national day of protest against the war. The idea is to inaugurate in the new Congress and the new session with an enormous statement that we are against the war and demand the troops home. United for Peace and Justice has links to protests all over the country, but in particular in Washington, D.C., where I'm leaving, getting on a plane tomorrow to go to. And then also a key moment in our area is on February 5th, the trial of Lieutenant Aaron Watata gets started in Tacoma, Washington. And I encourage everyone who can to go up there in support of Lieutenant Watata. He's taking a stand, which is that this is an illegal war, and therefore it's illegal for him and every other soldier and commander and U.S. government official to participate in that war. And that in supporting him and taking this position, we show every soldier who refuses to fight that there is an entire community that will stand up in support of him and her and give them our support and give them our attention, and in particular at their hour of need, which is when they go to trial. People can find out more about that on my website, thebushagenda.net.
And I'm speaking with Antonia Juhas. Again, she's policy analyst, author, and activist living in San Francisco. She's also a visiting scholar at the Washington, D.C.-based Institute for Policy Studies and author of the book, The Bush Agenda, Invading the World, One Economy at a Time. Again, the website she mentioned, thebushagenda.net. Any final comments as we wrap up today, Antonia?
Just that there really is the chance right now to turn the tide. I firmly believe that the Democrats are still trying to make up their mind about what the American public wants of them. Does the American public want them to take a firm stand and end the war, or is the American public not sure? And is it more in their interest, more in the Democrats' interest, to just let the Republicans burn themselves, and that's the way to win the 2008 presidential election? We have to let them know quite clearly that if they are interested in winning the election, if they're interested in holding on to their seats, that the American public is firm. They have to demand an end to the war right now.
Thank you so much, Antonia, for joining me today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Again, that was Antonia Juhas. You can check out her website at thebushagenda.net. And again, the title of her book is The Bush Agenda, Invading the World, One Economy at a Time. Thanks for listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.1 FM, streaming online at freakradio.org.